Hello and welcome to Careers in Your Ears, the Careers Podcast for PhDs and research staff at King's College London. This is a takeover series where PhDs and research staff from KCL will be interviewing researchers in careers in AI, sustainability, and social justice. I'm Mackenzie Jorgensen, a third year PhD student at King's, focusing on researching mitigating harm and discrimination from AI classification systems, and I'll be your host for this episode. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Louise Bizarro, the AI Center Lead and Responsible AI Leader at EY. So I think we should just jump right in. So Louise, what made you decide to do a PhD?
Hey, Mackenzie, thank you for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. What made me decide to do a PhD? Well, I had some really good mentors back in my engineering school. I come from Chile, and a few of my professors back then had done their PhDs abroad, most of them abroad. So they were telling me all sorts of exciting stories during their research, during their youth period, doing research abroad. And I was also one of the advanced students that we always had professors try to promote academic development. So some of those good students are usually approached by professors to ask them if they want to pursue an academic career, right? And back then, I was already doing, with my master, I was already doing some lecturing in computer science. And I really liked teaching. I really liked doing some early research. And I decided to do my PhD because I wanted to be an academic. That was the original aim I had. And it's interesting because in Latin America, most of the people that do a PhD is because they want to be academics, essentially. It's not quite related to work in industry. Mm. Luckily, this has been changing in the last few decades, but that was not my idea initially. I just wanted to be an academic.
Okay. And was AI something you were interested in from those early research experiences you had?
Definitely. For example, I was already working, playing with neural networks back in 2001.
Oh, wow.
And okay. We already had these type of courses back then, wavelets, signal processing, optimization agents. So we did have a complete artificial intelligence kind of specialization back then in my engineering school. Yeah, so going into this area was super smooth for me.
Okay, it's the natural progression, it sounds like.
Exactly. And I had to decide what to do specifically, in what field within. Right. Well, back then we were not all buzzing about the AI, right, 20 years mm-hmm. ago, but we knew computer science, we call it actually quantitative methods.
Okay.
All of this stuff was within the quantitative methods area in my major. So, yeah. And I was particularly interested in images, in videos, in computer vision, actually.
Sure.
That's what I went into doing.
Okay. And I guess with that kind of knowing that you wanted to go into academia, then did you always know that you wanted to go into industry later, or was there some kind of shift in your thinking or mm-hmm. some point in your...
Exactly. So I went to do my PhD in Germany. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, the DAAD scholarship from the German government. And when I was there, I realized a couple of things. First, that my studies were much longer back at home than the normal studies in Europe, not just in Germany, because I had studied 6 years engineering plus 2 years master's before jumping into my PhD. Well, careers in Europe were much shorter. So that was something that I puzzled me. And second is that the fact that a lot of the PhD students were really thinking of going into industry. And actually, in Germany, you have two types of PhDs, a sort of a scientific PhD and more engineering PhD. So the options are really open for PhD students. Some of them are really focusing on academic life. others onto industry life. And that's completely married. Both of them work quite well.
And then did you do kind of a mixture between those two?
Exactly. Although it took me some time to embrace more firmly the fact that I could actually work in industry. I was really focused on my academic path until I even did two postdocs after my PhD. And that means I really wanted to follow my academic career.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you're studying your supervisor, your main mentor, or did you have a mentor back in Chile or mentors from other parts?
I was lucky because I had mentors back in Chile, even professors that had studied in Germany, similar fields. And in Germany, I had a great professor, PhD advisor, and everyone in the computer science department were super approachable. Everyone. I had a lot of people that I can talk to discuss a variety of things, to be honest. It was a really amazing experience. It's important to have mentors, people you can talk to. If you have doubts, you have ideas even, you can pass them through them. And it makes the whole PhD experience much, much nicer rather than feeling isolated.
Definitely. Yeah, and it's good, I guess, to have people who gone through it as well.
Yes.
Who understand.
Exactly.
Especially as I imagine you reach the end of the PhD, that's especially helpful.
Exactly. Yeah. After my PhD in Germany, I decided to continue applying my theoretical work back then on image analysis, image processing, to some real life, still scientific scenarios, scientific problems in biomedical imaging. So that's the reason why I moved to London to do my first postdoc at Imperial College and second at UCL, working on biomedical images, essentially. And then of course I started to see how much this is very, very much needed in industry, right? Healthcare needs needs AI, needs people that can come up with certain algorithms for diagnosis, for treatment, right? And the biomedical field was that opportunity for me to apply all this theoretical knowledge, the theoretical techniques I was working on to analyze images and videos into that field, into biomedicine.
Right. I think that's a great use case as well for those kinds of technologies. Yeah. And I guess what do you find are the biggest similarities and differences between the research you've done in industry and the research you've done in
The answer to that question actually varies because there are currently huge companies that have large research departments. And I have friends that that work in those centers, and they say pretty much is the same as when they were doing their PhDs or their postdoc. Joining a company that has a large research centers, it's a luxury for those guys that actually want to do academic work fully dedicated to research, without necessarily being push to come up with the latest offering to clients, right? To the latest device. So there are such opportunities, right? For PhD students that want to go into industry, but focusing on their research, pure research necessities. And academia, essentially, something probably very specific to my case, to be successful in academia, to become an academic, you need to be laser focused in one niche field, right? And I never liked to focus, or I never thought of focusing in something for 30 years of my life. So that was one more reason why I decided to start doing other things. Apart from my academic focus, I started to collaborate with people from different fields, from different areas, to to try to do some contributions in different areas. And some of these areas were actually related to industry. Yeah. So probably the main difference is that there are certain industries that don't have these large research centers, but they still need to do some background research for you to understand how to best offer a specific service to clients or to the best way of developing a product also for clients. The difference there is that you don't have the luxury of unlimited time. Some in certain cases, like in academia, you have a lot of time to come up with your outcomes, and here you don't have that luxury. Normally, you need to work with very tight timelines when it's applied research, and also that means that you need to make sure that you have a working solution that might not necessarily achieve 95% performance, but you need a solution that is efficient, that achieve reasonable target performance. And this target, you can continuously improve it, but your first solution out needs to be ideally sufficient, not the most optimal, right?
The assumption that you'll keep tweaking it and improve.
Exactly. And also because for you to do a first piece of research in industry, you need to demonstrate value for that. So it's, let's say, stage one, you demonstrate some value. Then if that service or potential product you are investigating on gets the attraction of your stakeholders, of your bosses, of someone from outside, like clients, actual clients that are interested in that, then you move to stage two. So you start from prototyping to constructing a minimum viable product. And if things continue going well, then you can think of a full product to be built. So you do this applied research in stages, depending on essentially on market traction, right? If something doesn't have traction, you might have to move into a different piece, a different idea. Yeah.
Okay. And you'd mentioned you'd done some collaborations. And how did you find those collaborators? What kind of projects did you work on with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found those collaborators when attending certain conferences, and not only those international conferences, but also local. I spent 12 years in the UK, so I went to lots of meetings at the Royal Society, at the Cancer Research Institute, the BHF Institute, lots of places. And I could see the vast amount of imaging data that these organizations had, right? To look at biological samples, like really small nanometers. When you look at, when you, for example, in cancer research, you have electron imaging. And when you do also for whole body scanning, like MRI, or PET imaging. And there was a lack of professionals that had the understanding and how to manipulate those images from the mathematical point of view. So I was building models for mathematical analysis of those images. So that's how I started collaborating, but attending meetings where I could see how images are used in the field I was interested in. Right, in biomedicine. And then you get to talk to people and you have some common interests and things spark from there.
Yeah. It sounds like from an early stage you had that notion of talking to the real practitioners.
Exactly.
And bringing that into your research, which I think is so useful.
It's very important not just to stay in your research topic, but go out, talk to people, attend sessions. They don't have to be formal conferences, especially in the UK. There are so many meetups of all kinds. It's very important to attend those, also to expand your vision, right?
Yeah, I feel like it's very easy in academia, so be very...
Exactly. Think that you might have life after academia.
Yes, exactly. There is a real world.
Exactly.
Walls.
Absolutely.
Ask you another question. What advice would you give to a researcher who's unsure if they want to stay in academia, go into the private or public sector? I'm personally someone who is interested in research, career, and industry, while also keeping the door open to teach at university level, maybe as a visiting professor. So how do you develop that kind of open career, in a sense, to have the flexibility to move between the private sector and academia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. Not so straightforward to answer, but I have seen, myself, I was in that position, and a lot of colleagues and friends that I have met throughout the years. Of course, we all start in academia with a focus on pursuing an academic professorial path, right? Or actually go to do a PhD to learn the skills, very super specialized skills, let's say in text analytics, mm-hmm. natural language processing, because then I want to fund a startup. That's right. Very, very, very possible. Now, by having a PhD, you will always have the opportunity to move between academy and industry. For example, after doing your PhD, even if you spend some time doing a postdoc and you want to go to industry afterwards, and you can spend some time in industry and you are thinking, I really like the academic life, so you want to go back, it's not as difficult as it was a decade ago, because now in academia, they are, I won't say desperate, but they very much need people that have gone into industry, that have worked with real life problems, and bring this other angle into the academic field. And these people can actually work with students with a few more degrees of freedom, right? So to say, so you can always go back to academia. And if you have spent many years, as I was doing, in academia, and I wanted to jump to industry, you will face a barrier entry initially. Okay. Because in industry, if you have spent a lot of years in academia, people doubt whether you will adapt to the industrial pace, right? What I was telling you about, making sure that you can do some research or you can work as a machine learning engineer, with different timelines. Yeah. Now, 90% of people that I have known that were in such situations, they have successfully overcome any difficulties. They have successfully gone from being academic nerd. No, you know what I mean? So lots of years in research to be a successful person in industry. That's very possible. And once this person establishes in industry, it's very rapid, the progression, the career progression, because these are people that are very well prepared. Okay. Technically, by being in industry and by talking to people, attending meetings, conferences, you will always polish your interpersonal skills, right? Your conversational skills, which are important when you go into industry. So definitely you can move between these two life paths.
Perfect. And I do think that professors who have had some interesting experience were so wise, I guess, in a way. I really enjoyed learning from them.
Exactly.
My undergrad degree.
And what we have seen in the last decade is the avalanche of professors that have started their own companies, their own startups, right? Even universities normally have an incubator program exactly for internal professors and PhD students that would like to commercialize their research. So that's also very common nowadays. So I think really it's much easier as it was 15, 20 years ago to move between, at least in my experience, to move between these two career paths. Now you have a lot of more options.
Yes. Giving me a lot of hope, Louise.
Yes.
And given you have roles at EY and King's College London, so you have that academic and that industrial combination, how you organize yourself and make sure that you're able to get done your kind of competing tasks and still reach the goals that you set for yourself.
Yeah, that's important. You mentioned goal. You need to organize yourself with goals. Of course, first understand what is expected from your roles. And sometimes you don't just need to hear from your PI, from your boss at that time, what you should be doing, but also you can come up with your own ideas, your own goals and targets. But you need to write this down. Because you need, especially in industry, your outputs need to be measurable. So your goals need to be accompanied with some metrics, right? So the same whether you do work in industry or in academy, I had to, right, set up my goals and how I can achieve these goals with my colleagues, with my teams, and dedicate time to those. So because a lot of people work on to-do lists, like enormous long lists of things to do. We try to prioritize those lists, but essentially the most effective way to work is you can still have that to-do list, prioritize what is essential, and move those lines of work into your calendar. So you dedicate yourself a certain amount of time to get that done. Otherwise, it's very difficult to keep track on what you need to do and the progress and what's next. So of course, yeah, organization is quite key, and having a team that can support you, especially if you are doing collaborations with different organizations, like in my case. Yeah, it's not impossible, but organization is key.
Yeah. And do you use any specific tools? Like, do you have a Trello board or other kinds of toolkits?
And I have my own tracker.
Okay.
Essentially, I keep it simple. It's an Excel file, right? With
Okay.
my specific columns, like the type of initiative I'm working on, of course the contact people, the expected outcomes for each one of those initiatives, who I have to work with from my team, right? Who is supporting that? Estimated time to be allocated, status, are we at initial phase, are we on a planning phase, executing phase, so try to have my own tracker, and then for those activities that need an action from my side particular, then I make sure I bring those actions into my diary so I can get them done.
I'm done.
Inviting. Exactly. Whether it's time for myself to do something or time I need to talk to people to coordinate what we need to do. So yeah, I try to keep it simple. I know there are some more sophisticated tools, but that has worked for me so far.
I mean, then keep on doing it.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to have us zoom out a bit more and kind of talk about AI in general. So currently, what do you see are the greatest challenges the AI field presently?
Yeah, there is so much to talk about because although AI, people might argue, is 70 years old, maybe more, depending, right? We are still in very early stages in regards to general intelligence, right? Honestly, I don't think we're gonna get there probably in the next 30 years or more. So there are a few challenges. For example, we know that AI is very good at doing specific things, right? Provided you have a good amount of training data. So if you are doing some supervised learning, you need a lot of data, but essentially to learn something very specific, right? How to classify objects, right? So that is one aspect that we need to get better at in general. How do we go from large data to small data? Being really good at doing those supervised tasks with as little data as possible, Yeah, it's very relevant because there are lots of scenarios where you have little annotated data or little examples, very few examples, and that's it, because the scenarios are so difficult in some scenarios to collect measurable data, to collect examples. So that's one thing. How do we go from large to small data for supervised learning? In those scenarios where there is actually no annotation, no labels, no samples, you can resort to unsupervised learning, right? And then that means you can use clustering type of algorithms, manifold learning types of techniques, and that means we need more of those, right? We need more of those type of techniques because real industrial scenarios are often challenged by the lack of certain data, the lack of examples, right? So we need to make sure that we can understand behavior, analyze a data set where you don't necessarily have the target objective, right, the target variable, right, or samples per category. So manifold learning techniques are essential there. And so all of this, essentially, going back to my initial comment, we know that AI currently is very good at doing super specific things. And that's because we currently don't understand very well how humans represent knowledge. Because if we can understand those mechanisms, then we should be able to learn some activities and extrapolate, right, how to teach certain agents to do activities they were not specifically programmed for. An example, if you learn how to play Pac-Man, or you train an agent how to play Pac-Man, how to play Need for Speed, a racing, right? Then ideally, you can the agent can learn the intricacies of gaming and then apply. So that agent should immediately apply that knowledge to other types of games, right? It could be from very like old generation, like Mario Bros. Or Pac-Man, as I said, or very modern games. So I think the gaming industry or the gaming setting is quite good to test this type of representation learning, because you can even create a lot of training data. You can simulate scenarios within a gaming, in gaming, and then use that for training. And ideally, you can represent that knowledge somehow and try to extrapolate the learnings from a couple of games into a completely different game.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess, right?
Exactly.
Structured environments, and you're able to control a lot of different variables.
Exactly. Yeah, simulation is part of how you can actually get some training data. Yeah. One more thing, which is we have all been affected by that, is the how can we tackle disinformation or fake mm-hmm. news? It's something that is super relevant for democracy even, right? So I see that this is a great challenge we have ahead. And I see the text analytics field, right? Natural language processing, natural language understanding, together with computer vision, to combine the strengths from these two areas into tackling, identifying what disinformation is, what fake news is, and put some an outlier, yeah. an outlier detector for these type of things. Yeah. They're more becoming in layers, unfortunately, more and more present. So I think this is something we need to tackle. It's a challenge. And we might have currently some really good advances in the natural language world and in computer vision, because when it comes to speech, right, you can analyze videos, but also voice, and you can analyze text at the same time. So I think that's super important. Finally, a challenge that I see in AI has to do with responsible AI. Essentially, currently, we are aware of lots of systems that have been deployed by governments, by big tech, by the public and private sector. And this these systems have mistreated certain groups of people, right? They've been treating them unfair. So some of these systems directly or indirectly impact humans, even the environment. So that means we need standards for data usage, standards for AI development, AI governance, and AI auditing. Because if now with the regulation that is coming, we have to tell the agency that we have been building a system that might affect people, right? Because, for example, someone in college or in high school might get a place in a particular university or college, and an algorithm is deciding, right? Or someone that is seeking for certain treatment, healthcare treatment, gets or not that treatment at a specific institution, or when does it get it? So the regulators are telling first thing that we need to do some internal auditing of how we have built that system, and then potentially the agencies will be conducting external audits. So we need to establish what standards we need to apply, how we govern that those standards are indeed followed by the product teams that are implementing these systems, and then we can do the due diligence internally to make sure that, so we do internal audit essentially. So this is challenging and it's evolving thanks to the regulations all over the place, right?
Do you have the EU AI Act in mind?
Exactly. There are at least 7 or 8 jurisdictions that are working heavily on this. The US, Canada, South Korea, China. Exactly. Singapore. Right.
Yeah.
These are the more advanced countries. Of course, lots of countries have already declared their AI principles or their AI strategies for the next decade. But in terms of regulation, these are the jurisdictions, the countries that are more advanced in that in that respect.
I do find it interesting how the tech world research is so quick to change and quick to improve. But sometimes I feel like the policy struggles to keep up almost, and preventative methods don't always work.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm in favor of not regulating the actual technology, but the usage of that technology. Because you can have a very harmless decision tree, so it's nothing complex, right? But that decision tree can be used in a military scenario or in a medical scenario. And these are essentially the impacts on people and other societal effects that these applications might have is what we need to be regulated.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. The domain factor.
Exactly.
Discussions. That was a really interesting answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Moving on, what aspects of AI do you see are the most promising and currently, I guess, and into the near future?
Right. Yes. Also, I can connect this question in regards to the promising areas also with the challenges. Something we are all aware of is that most of the AI machine learning techniques we use regularly are based on correlations among variables, right? And we know that some correlations are spurious, just by chance, right? So the number of murderers in, or the amount of deaths by assassination in New York is very highly correlated with the amount of sales of ice cream, right? So you wouldn't like to predict how many people have died because of that, based on how many ice cream sales were were reported in the last month, or if you want to predict exactly. So this is correlation, but it's not the causal association, right? So causal ML, I think, is one of the key areas that we need to continue working. I would say people have started to work on that probably 10 years from now, maybe 5 years most strongly, but still a lot needs to be done, because essentially the question is, the current techniques that we have in supervised learning, unsupervised learning, reinforcement learning, can they be adapted to now exploit or to discover causal relationships rather than just correlations? Or we need to come up with completely different sets of techniques, right? And I think this is very important. In industry, you always want to understand why an action is needed. So you need to have the lineage, the linkage between states in order to take an action. So causality is very, very important there for real applications particularly. Yeah.
Community, that causality is starting to pop up more.
Exactly.
The top conferences, so it's something I want to look into.
Exactly. Maybe I can mention two more things briefly. Graph ML, right? Graphical ML for me is also an area that it needs a lot of attention. It's currently having a lot of attention, and I see just that more and more is going to come. Essentially, how do you can represent a problem in the usual two-dimensional grid or three-dimensional grid or n-dimensional grid. Mm-hmm. But when you represent your problem as a graph, you have much more freedom, mm-hmm. right? As relationships between nodes, as relationships like parent-child relationships. So a graph gives you all that flexibility. And there are algorithms that now run on graphs very efficiently.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think graph ML is something that is a compulsory skill in the next 5 years.
Okay. I'll check that out then.
Yeah. And probably the last thing I find really interesting, the area of collaborative agents, right? Because nowadays we see more and more that there are small devices, small robots with a low computing power that can do a specific task. So essentially you can have a tremendous task ahead that you can try to simplify by dividing into smaller tasks and assign each task to a device, to an agent. So how do you make these agents collaborate, right? What are the type of algorithms that you need to utilize to train a collection of agents to accomplish a task together? Right. Mm-hmm. And especially if those agents are small units that don't have a lot of computing power, you can even think of a mobile, right? So all thousands, millions of mobiles working together, for example, to accomplish a given task. So that's edge computing. But more general, collaborations of agents, it's very, very important in the next few years.
Yeah, for sure. And even in a self-driving car context, I feel like if we have a bunch of self-driving cars, they need to communicate with one another situations
exactly like federated learning. Mm-hmm. Right, you need to split how you learn, because your resources or your where you need to solve a problem is in a different location. Also, federated learning is useful for safety yeah. reasons. So there are lots of branches that you can think of when it comes to collaboration of agents and how they are arranged, how they yeah. communicate. It's amazing. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's not just robots, right? But sure. processes. Yeah.
Yeah. I think those are some great points. Before I wrap up, I have one more question. What advice do you wish you could have given yourself, or I guess your previous PhD self?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. well, you learn, of course, after lots of years, yeah. being working at the edge between academia and an industry. When I was a postdoc at Imperial and UCL, I was supervising some PhD students, and they ended up establishing their startups, right? They funded the startups, they got funding, and actually they had a good exit strategy and they sold their startups. And of course, they continue working on technology. And that's something that I would tell myself, going back, that I could try to connect my theoretical research back then with real life industry applications, which could potentially lead to, well, two things: that my research gets into the applications much faster, right, making it useful, and second, I could also fund my startup after my PhD or soon after a few years of postdoc. I think that's something that probably everyone should be aware of. Nowadays, a lot of research can be turned into some real life industry applications. It's not for everyone. A lot of people are really into theoretical advancements, which is perfectly fine.
I think that's a good point. That entrepreneurship is always something that researchers can think about and consider.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Luis, for joining us, sharing your experiences and thoughts. We'll wrap up. So you can find me, Mackenzie, on LinkedIn. And if guys at King's are around Bush House, give me a shout and I'm happy to meet for a coffee nearby. Join us next time on Careers in Your Ears, when we'll be continuing our exploration of researcher careers. To hear more from King's Careers Consultants for Researchers, give them a follow on Twitter @KCLDoOneThing. Thanks so much, y'all.